It is Saturday, July 28, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, our Week in Geek News. And then in the second half, your questions and comments of technology.
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we are covering the geek news of the week, and in the second half, we're taking your questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can contact us right now. Just go to geekspeak.org. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour.
Here at the Carmel Bach Festival at KUSP tomorrow morning at 11 a.m., presenting The Passion According to St. Matthew by J.S. Bach. Recorded just 1 week ago, this performance features vocal and instrumental soloists, chorale, chorus, and orchestra, all conducted by Bruno Wheel. The St. Matthew's Passion tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. On the Sunday morning classical fog lift.
GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, slacker and student. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems.
Good morning.
And Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA.
Good morning, Lyle.
Well, geeks, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Before we take calls in the second half, let's go ahead and do some geek news. Miles, I'll start with you.
News is out that the University of California security researchers have looked at every voting machine that has been approved for use by the state of California and have found that all of them are vulnerable in some way or another. All of them have been cracked.
Security vulnerabilities.
Security vulnerabilities. And this test was ordered by the Secretary of State in California, Deborah Bowen, who has until Friday to decide whether or not to decertify any of those machines for any elections, like, for example, the primary elections that are coming up. So this is going to be I'm assuming, going to be a pretty big push in that direction of decertifying them.
So the basic idea is the California state has some kind of certification process. They went ahead and certified a whole bunch of systems
right. Based
on these processes. And then this legislator said, you know what, let's go ahead and test them, even though we've approved them.
It's a bit more complicated than that. It's that after they had been certified, some of the voting machine companies had changed the machines or changed software after the certification was complete, certification process.
Oh, interesting.
Which was against the rules. And there were some talks of some machines getting certified when they shouldn't have, when they failed certain criteria. And there has also been a big uproar by the public saying we want some accountability for these machines. And people remembering very vividly in their head 2004 elections where Ohio had a huge problem with voting machines and questioned the status of that election, federal elections.
Who is this person that decided to have them tested by University of California researchers?
The Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen.
That's great.
So she'd be the person in charge of saying...
She should be applauded for doing something like this. I mean, it seems like a good first step in...
Well, it's good that any public official does take a look at it, and all of them should. At the same time, this very much is her jurisdiction.
Okay, how many different machine models are we talking about? Do you know? Are we talking like 5, 10? Do you know?
That I don't know off the top of my head.
But all of 100% of the ones that have been certified.
Right.
Someone needs to be responsible.
I'd agree. Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
And shouldn't there be patches, just like for any other, you know,
but
system?
Absolutely, there should be patches, but those patches should be applied before they are certified. Certification should mean that they've gone through the testing process and they have, you know, come out saying, okay, we've tested these and they work out. If you find a vulnerability, they should be decertified, go through the certification process again after you've made all of the changes. Would it be pricey? Yes, but it's worth it.
Of course, the Contra Costa County clerk and head of the State Association of Clerks and Election Officials said that giving hackers source codes, operating manuals, and unlimited access to the voting machines is like giving a burglar the keys to your house. So he's saying that perhaps they had an edge because they were given all of this to crack the machines.
What do you think about that,
Not
Miles?
Something that, you know, they were given more than just the machines.
Yeah. What do you think, Miles?
That does affect it, sure. Yeah, at the same time, being given, for one thing, I remember the Diebold machines, there was a big hubbub a little while back where in their marketing literature, they show the Diebold machine and next to it was a key. And just so happened that key was the key to unlock the Diebold machine. There only was one key for every machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a picture of it online and people just looked at the picture, made a key that looked exactly like it, and sure enough, it worked. So admittedly, that is outside just having the machine and not having full access to manuals and the like, but it's the type of thing where with paper, you have humans involved. You have something that you can do a physical recount with.
Sure.
With electronic voting, a lot of them don't have a paper trail, or if they then...
Let's say I'm focused to Sean's point.
But even if they have the source code, haven't they ever heard of encryption?
Right.
I mean, there should be... Just because you understand how something works doesn't mean you should have access to the information that system protects.
Well, I was thinking that this person that mentioned, like, it's like giving all this information to burglars. It's like giving the blueprints of your house to burglars, but not the keys. So, yeah, want to see that your house is designed, your security design is good. And, yeah, you can't give them the secrets. The secrets are the part that make it secure. But you need that.
I mean, you may know where the safe is, right? That doesn't mean you can get inside the safe.
That's exactly right. In fact, you should know to find out how secure your safe is, you can go ahead and give the blueprints of the safe out to somebody. It's okay because it's designed to be above and beyond that part of the secret. Any case, fascinating story. I'd love to keep following this because I want to know, are these machines going to be used anyway? Because I have an interesting idea here. Let's say a company makes a machine. They get approved. You know, they get certified. Then a body goes in and rechecks it. And all of a sudden, this company's up to lose a lot of capital. You would think that they'd want to fight the state on this issue.
I would think, why not put the security researchers as part of the University of California or Caltech or any of those in charge of, I mean, as part of the certification process that they have to pass.
Like, what Alex says here in his instant message, public disclosure or threat of seems to unfortunately be the thing that makes companies be responsible to actually fix things.
That's right.
So it's this kind of thing that gets things fixed.
It's why we want
this kind of reporting.
It's why we want transparency in government. We want transparency in a lot of things.
And Miles, by the way, it says the study also determined that many voting systems have flaws that make it difficult for blind voters and those with other disabilities to cast ballots.
Which was one of the primary reasons to have electronic voting machines in the first place. So that's just...
Wait, why?
That was one of the primary reasons to have electronic voting machines. It wasn't necessarily the speed of it because you have optical scanners as well. It was because
they were just printed.
Because they were just printed, you would need another person in there with you to help with the voting process, which means you have someone else seeing how you're voting. Usually it was a family member or a close friend. But with a screen, you could plug in headphones and have it read to you their choices and then choose them along with, you know, choices for Braille, although they have those for paper ballots to be able to Braille choice. But so,
all right, well,
you take away that advantage and
if testers had more time, they could have found more flaws is what they determined.
All right. Electronic voting in California is being scrutinized by people that get to look at a lot of the information, and everything's failing. Thank you, Miles, very much for bringing up that story. Let's go on with the Geek News. Ryder, I'll go to you.
Hi. So on Tuesday, there was a huge power outage affecting over 30,000 people in San Francisco, and it hit a large data center up in San Francisco called 365 Main.
This is kind of one of those famous data centers, right, that does advertising?
Yeah, it hosts a lot of really popular websites. You know, there's some posts on the internet saying, like, every website you care about is down, basically. Craigslist, Yelp, Netflix.
This is a major hosting facility.
How could it go down because of a power outage?
That's the question. They had a 1 week backup electrical system that apparently didn't kick in. I'm been kind of scouring. I can't figure out why it didn't kick in, but you know, they've made touts. I had a friend that's gone on tour there, and you know, that was a major selling point for them, is that they have 1 week backup.
Power
systems.
Can go down for a week and we're
for
still
a week,
up.
Yeah, yeah, and they don't need any additional wow. fuel. They're self-contained. You know, they could have a dirty bomb go off and they'll be, you know,
be
fine. But
there's enough food for the staff in
yeah,
there for a
but
week.
Apparently a transformer blew up in San Francisco and took out, you know, whole area,
and their generator didn't come up.
They went down, yeah. So I knew Netflix was down for a while. You know, it's a big popular DVD rental store, and
Craigslist. That's a big one.
Craigslist is big. My company's Sun, their main website went down. They're not completely hosted there at all. But
wow,
it sounds like this is probably a system that was put together over time, right?
Yeah,
so it wasn't designed mm-hmm. from the beginning with the backup generator support.
They added
so
it?
They had no way to test it. I bet it was added in. And they had no way. Of course, once something's added into an already existing system that has to be up 24/7, 365,
yeah, you
know,
how
do you test it?
Yeah, yeah.
And they've had like a 2-year uptime, you know.
They've been really good.
Been really good. And they have an interesting billing method where they only charge their clients for the amount of power that they consume.
You know, Lyle, we should have our hosting facility.
Oh, it was all free that day.
Oh, did they determine how much money was lost?
No, I haven't seen
because okay, so maybe they're not charging them for the hosting for that day, but how much money did these companies lose?
Massive amounts, I'm sure.
And are they going to cover that?
Well, it brings into question: do they have redundant data centers that they can fall back on?
You'd think that wouldn't have affected anything. One data center dropping on these large customers, they should be mirrored in other locations.
Yeah,
we don't have to.
Yeah, some of the responsibility has to be on these people who have their servers there, right? They should have backup.
We have a great connection with a guy that is in this business. We should have him on the show and talk about this.
That's what I was
thinking. How does redundancy exist? And we'll ask Derek Weiss, who's owner of GNI, who's one of the sponsors of our website, actually. He hosts us. We should have him on, talk about how can a data center like that, at that magnitude, fail? Once they release the press releases explaining what happened and everything, we'll have him on.
His data center is incredible.
Yeah, well,
when we went down there, I was just blown away.
Wonderful place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, we'll cover that again. Thank you, Ryder, for letting us know about that. Sean, do you have a specific story you want to cover? Should I go back to Miles?
I've been sick and effectively out of the tech world for the past 3 days, so and I'm on cold medicine, so I don't think I want to cover
I think your
anything.
Voice sounds sexy, but Miles, what's the next story, sir?
Well, here's a quick story. It's somewhat related. There's been some commentary at the Nature Climate Change, which is a website organization, that says that the energy savings associated with background colors used by high-traffic websites could be significant. For example, they were saying, back-of-the-envelope calculation, if Google changed their background to black instead of white,
I've heard
with all the people that are accessing Google, you would. He was suggesting that we would save 700 megawatt hours per year just by that one change.
Right. Now, didn't we cover this before, Miles?
Did we?
I've seen it in the past. Okay. What comes, you know, the first thing I think of is like, okay, this really only applies to CRT monitors,
right?
Not LCDs, which are probably the predominant, you know,
right?
Display.
And changing to LCD monitors would probably make a so much bigger difference.
Yeah. But changing to black or white is not going to make any difference on an LCD monitor.
Right, right. Because LCD monitors, backlight's always on.
Yeah.
Right, which was a point being made by the Wall Street Journal about that, saying there are other technologies that are reducing the power constraints.
Yeah, I've seen some fights against it.
But if Google had come out 10 years ago.
Let's be clear about what the idea behind this is, that a CRT monitor, normal television-type monitor, the big thick ones that actually shoot electron ray towards you, but in a vacuum, so you're safe, don't worry about it. They light up.
They're lead-shielded.
Yeah, yeah, sure. They light up. Well, and that beam of electrons would stop in air when a few inches. But in any case, it's hitting this fluorescent screen, and it... Wherever it hits the fluorescent screen, it produces light, and that's the actual pixels you see on a CRT or television-type monitor, old-type monitor. And white causes it to use energy, and black basically means it's off. So the idea being is if Google is a black screen, you save a lot of energy not lighting those pixels up. And what you guys are saying is that for LCDs, there's no effect because, of course, the LCD just has a big light in the back, and the pixels either show or don't show the light.
And LCD monitors use up so much less than CRTs that you're already saving money there.
Right.
Yeah, the problem is Google's logo is multicolored, and it would look horrible on black.
That's true. Yeah.
And then people will go to their page and say, what's going on? This isn't Google.
Yeah, and on a related note, if you have a 17-inch CRT monitor that you're using, You would probably, I mean, you almost definitely save money by buying a 17-inch LCD. We'd get actually another inch of real estate space as well. And the cost of electricity over the course of the year, it would probably pay for itself. It would definitely pay for itself over the life of the monitor.
What, a 17-inch monitor is like $100 now, something like that? An LCD?
$150.
$150?
Yeah.
For baseline.
And, well, we could do the calculation.
And a 17-inch monitor is going to be like if you have a television, and that television is on at a good portion of the time.
Yeah.
Even when it's in standby mode, it's using anywhere between 5 and 15 watts.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's better for your eyes.
All right. Thanks, Miles, for that interesting story about an old story.
well, it's always good to remind people to save energy.
That's true. Saving energy is a good thing. Ryder.
So I came across this article that talks about Maglev wind turbines. You guys ever heard of that?
Is that the vertical
wind turbines? No, but if you, how many few bars
Maglev?
There, can I have that sheet?
Yeah. There are, it's kind of a new technology that's, it's intended to be more efficient wind turbine technology that's 20% more efficient.
Okay.
Do they kill birds like the yellow one, the older ones?
Probably, yeah.
Not as much as cats in the United States kill birds, though. So if you want to save birds in the United States, get rid of your cats.
Don't let your cats go
outside.
Don't complain about wind turbines.
That's right. So these wind turbines.
They're basically, the premise of it is that it uses magnets to levitate the mechanics so that there's
no
bearings. Uh-huh. It's basically an almost zero friction device that has low resistance, so very low winds can cause the turbine to start rotating and generating electricity.
But there is some energy loss in that levitation, isn't there? Or is it all done with static magnets?
You know, there's probably static magnet versions, which would be much more expensive to create than electromagnetic versions.
But even if a small breeze could give you a little bit of power, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm picturing in my head a mountainside filled with these, and then somehow the power goes out, and all these things drop. They start rolling down the hill because they look like big cylindrical objects.
Oh, turn your screen around. Let me see.
You got to describe to our viewers what these things look like. They look dangerous if they were to fall.
They look like a big vacuum canister.
With blades.
With blades.
I'm picturing these rolling down hills.
it's huge. I mean, they're vertical towers. There's one that's been proposed that they put up in Arizona to power 750,000 homes.
No kidding.
Well, how much power is that? What's the...
Let's see if we can find that on here.
750 homes. Didn't you hear them?
Except for the fact
that... You know
what?
We need the URL, please.
Homes if they aren't running a dishwasher? What? I mean, what's...
750 homes with just the fluorescent lighting? So all the appliances are gas.
It's called Maglev. It's M-A-G-L-E-V.
It's important to say the number of homes. The average home, I guess, would be useful, but still you need to...
Sure.
What is it, 10,000 homes per megawatt is the...
Site here that talks about it. In China, they've actually got some real things that they've built here, not just proposed. And they were talking, which I thought was interesting, they were talking about they could mount these generators on the side of the highways and power all the lighting on the highway just based on the airflow generated by the vehicles passing by.
Now that's really interesting. What a great idea.
Except that you're stealing from the people that are using the highway. Because... As Miles has pointed out multiple times, if there is a wind in the highway going the direction of traffic flow and you're in that, you save gas mileage, right? So if you slow that wind down by using it for generation...
That's not true.
Then you're taking
this
gas...
This is wind that's already been used by vehicles.
No,
it's because a vehicle to go from, say, 50 miles an hour to 70 miles an hour is a huge amount of air resistance. It's a huge difference. So if you have wind going behind you
at 10 miles an hour...
Then you don't have that same level.
But we're talking about turbines on the side of the road.
The
energy has already gone off the road and has moved to the side of the road.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, if you're talking about physics here, right?
Yeah. Well,
if you're talking about an open air freeway, you're not going to get much energy off that wind that's just off the side of the road.
You also understand that wind that goes off the side of the road, if it's leaving the freeway, that means the lower pressure on the freeway, air has to go back in. And if you resist the air that's flowing out, less air goes back in.
That's true,
too. So the actual energy output is, if you're taking energy from the system, you are going to need it from somewhere.
Yeah.
And the source would be the cars, gas engines, or electrical.
And gas engines are not the most efficient form of energy transfer.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Okay. And I got some, some stats here on that. They're saying that it can, if you were to use this in a wind farm, it could reduce operational expenses up as much as 50%.
Cool.
And the cost of driving this wind power is below five cents per kilowatt hour.
We're just talking about the design of this thing,
yeah,
and how much better, yeah, it is than those traditional, yeah, turbines. Cool.
So that's minimal cost in terms of whether this is electromagnetic or, I'm not sure. They're talking about electromagnetic.
Cool. Thank you, Ryder, sure, very much for that. I think we have time for one more news story before we invite people to call in. Miles, it's yours.
Cell towers, also known as they're called phone masts in the UK. So if I happen to say a phone mast, it means that I'm talking about the study done in England.
Okay.
Now, what they were doing was trying to figure out, people talk about electrosensitivity all the time and the effects of cell towers on their health, especially cell towers, things that are transmitting energy, not just, and they will also talk about it in terms of computers. But this study was done on cell towers, the effect of them. And they got together 44 people who considered themselves electrosensitive, and they got together a larger group, 114, who had never reported any ill effects from cell towers, and put them together and put them in front of a cell tower, but they were flipping a switch, basically, whether the cell tower would be on or off. And if they turned it on and then they told the person the cell tower is on, they showed physical effects, the people who said that they were electrosensitive. However, when they had it on and they didn't tell the person, those effects went away. In addition, if they didn't turn the cell tower on, but they told the person that they were on, the people who were electrosensitive tended to say that they felt it, even though there was no power being applied to it.
All right,
this is one of the first studies being done that has what we call here a double-blind test.
Control group, too, yeah. Well, I mean, assuming the controllers didn't know.
The control group basically said they never could feel anything.
Oh. So what are the numbers on this?
Yeah, what did they determine?
Yeah.
It sounds like they determined that people aren't affected by these.
Well, that's what they determined. There was something that was off on that, in that 12 of the sufferers dropped out of the trial because they said that they felt too ill to continue,
mm-hmm,
which then leaves 32 people and still in the group. But what they found was that two of the 44 sensitive individuals correctly judged if it was on or off in all six tests.
Oh.
But that correlates with chance.
Oh.
If you the number, sure, of times that they
so
tried
basically
it, there's a certain number that are going to...
This study's conclusion is that people actually can't, or this group of people couldn't tell the difference?
Well, this is one study that was a double-blind test. It's one of the first times that they've actually tested using a double-blind experiment and actually had independent study.
So that those people who correctly identified, mm-hmm, every time it was on and off, it could be chance, or it could be that a small percentage of the population is actually affected by cell phone,
right,
towers.
And that other people are just neurotic.
Did they say what that possibility might be? Or
No, they did say that neurotic. It was a possibility, that it was, in fact, a possibility. There were, in fact, physical reactions that they could measure from the entire group that stated that they were electrosensitive.
Oh, okay.
Which also applies to the placebo effect.
Yeah, yeah,
that,
right.
And that's why you have a double-blind study, is what is in your head and, yeah, what is an actual response from external stimuli.
They were still affected even when the cell tower was off.
So basically,
physically, because their mind,
right,
said...
Because,
yeah,
they told them that it was on.
Yeah.
So their mind is more dangerous than the cell towers, basically.
This program is supported by PreOwnedCar.com. PreOwnedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicles for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information is available at PreOwnedCar.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. Stay tuned with Castle Cottage this morning, right after Geek Speak on KUSP at 11 a.m. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle, and you're listening to Geek Speak. In the air are also Ryder, Miles, and Sean. And please join our conversation right now. We're taking any calls today about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. And of course, you just go to our website if you'd like to send us email. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. All right, as we wait for calls, we've got one more news story.
So, I just noticed that you got your wind turbine story from a site called treehugger.com.
It's funny he sent me the URL.
So I had to go to treehugger.com's, you know, tops level,
the
homepage, and see what it was like. And there's even Treehugger TV, which you can watch at treehugger.com. But there's a story there called Harvesting the Energy of Crowds. And they say, wouldn't it be great, especially the day before, you know, the biggest shopping day of the year, day after Thanksgiving, you know, or around Christmas time, if we could harness the energy of crowds walking in malls. And there are people at MIT who are actually doing that.
So what would this be like, a tracks on the ground? Or,
you know, I haven't dug into the story, but harvesting the energy of crowds. I don't know.
Forget crowds. Use 3-year-olds. That would be impressive.
Yes.
I wonder what they're basing the energy on. They're talking because you got body heat, noise, wind.
Yeah, I think of whenever I go to a shopping center or something like that, you're always hearing people talk about, oh, I need to get off my feet. I've been up on my feet all day. I can't. Yeah, you want them to exercise and put more energy into the system to do that, because most of their energy is spent in locomotion. So yeah. Anything that you gather from that would have to be in addition to the basic locomotion.
Yeah. I think treehugger.com. I don't know, man.
Another story says, woman recycles herself.
Okay,
Are you trying to attack Ryder's cool news story about Magno?
When you see that headline, don't you want to read it?
No,
woman recycles herself.
That headline sounds like something that'll get Lyle in trouble with the FCC. Like, don't.
She actually got stuck in a recycling bin. That's the story. All right, let's move on.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take we're going to take a call from Lompico. Larry from Lompico, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, I'm a spyware issue.
You got a spyware issue?
Yeah, spyware, and it has to do with the pop-up window that says log on to AirProtector.com.
So you keep on getting a pop-up window that gives you log into this other site to will protect your computer?
Yeah, it says AirProtector.com, and I can log on to that. But this is the issue: is that I've got a Windows. I got the newest computer and this Vista and all that stuff, and
you're still getting error messages.
Yeah, well, I'm getting this. That's the thing. I'm not getting error messages. It's just a little window that pops up.
Okay, we're going to diagnose this problem a little bit. First off, stop giving out the URL because it's spam, and I don't want anybody to go there. Next thing, are you doing? You're only getting this pop up when you're browsing the web with a browser.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm using Mozilla.
You're using Mozilla. And what site are you visiting that's doing this?
Well,
all sites?
The question is that, that's a really good question you're asking me, because you're trying to pinpoint it to an exact website that's triggering this.
It's possible.
Unless you clicked on a link inside of an email.
No, it's not. It doesn't have to do with email, but I like that idea of a specific website. But the problem is that I have various websites open and sitting open.
Right.
It's very
possible that one of those websites has a script that just keeps on calling a pop-up. Now, I think pop-up blocking on Mozilla is
off. Well, it could be the browser,
default.
Or it could be that he's infected with something.
Yeah, it could be either.
That is invoking the browser to go somewhere with a pop-up.
Pop-up blocking is enabled by default in Firefox. However, I know that there are deficiencies in, for example, the Flash plugin that will allow pop-up windows even when you don't want them to.
Okay, well, let's diagnose whether we think this is actual happening while he's browsing or not. So is this window that pops up, is it an Internet Explorer pop-up, or is it a Firefox or Mozilla pop-up? Do you know?
It's actually popping up out of the bar at the bottom. There's like a little thing that comes up, a little window.
Mm-hmm. It tells me something's running resident in the background of the system.
What
happens is that the window, my Mozilla window, shuts down, and then that thing pops up like, hey, you're infected. But
you know what?
Antivirus and a scan and all that stuff.
Well, you are correct that you are infected. However, what they're trying to get you to buy is probably the person that infected you, rather than.
Now wait a second. I'm not sure that he is infected. it's possible that we're just experiencing a situation where another pop-up happens. But you're saying because the other browsers are minimizing, then he probably is.
The first thing I would do is you need to stop any process that's running in the background. Anything that gets loaded with Windows that might be... It sounds to me like you've got something running in the background.
But Vista is such a new operating system. Do you know all the processes that run in Vista?
Yeah.
Well, no. I don't care about what Vista is running itself in the background. I care about third-party applications that are running in Vista.
Right, but how do you know the difference?
Right, well, because if you look at the... Even if you look in XP, all the processes... I don't know all of
them. Okay, listen, Sean?
If you go to start and run... actually, there is no run in Vista. You just go to start, and on the little line right there, you type msconfig. That will bring up a dialog box that allows you to choose which application start up with Windows, right? So you click on the startup tab, and anything that's there in that startup tab, you can actually, you don't have to run it. That's all stuff that does not need to be run with Vista. It's not needed.
And Larry mentioned that he's using AVG virus protection, right? So that's probably going to be in that list.
So I would get rid of, turn everything off and see if the pop-up goes away.
In configuration right now.
Yeah, see, so go to that startup tab and take the check mark off everything there.
For AVG.
I'm looking at system configuration window and it's tabs. General boot service startup, okay.
Startup.
So... I'm thinking that there's something running there when Windows starts up. This is everything that's there with a check mark next to it will start up with Windows. Will run in the background. Will use up your system resources. You don't need to run any of this stuff.
Okay.
So I would go through there and look for things you don't know, and take the check mark off.
Now, it's very possible that you downloaded an application of some kind, like a music sharing application or something, and part of that install is one of these things that does, quote, advertising. And that's not exactly called spyware in general, but sometimes the idea of whether it's kind of a good thing or a bad thing is really up to you.
That's a good point. When you install software, you really shouldn't just let it install automatically. You really should do a manual install and go through that. There'll be extra screens, and it'll tell you exactly what's being installed. And think about what they want you to install, because a lot of that you don't need. If you just want the basic application, like Winamp does this, great application. It's free. It lets you listen to music. It's got much more functionality than Windows Media Player. But Winamp wants to install other things on your computer. Like they'll put an icon on your desktop to get free MP3s. Well, I don't want that. I don't want access to that service. And you don't have to install that if you use their manual install. You would then say, don't install that. Well, it's the same with all applications. You just got to be careful. When you install an app, just don't take it that they're going to install that application.
Okay.
They're making money, and they want to install other software.
Now, with that general warning, Miles, do you want to add some parts that make this a little more complicated?
Well, once again, I want to say
I'll have a solution for you.
The pop-up that's coming up that's saying, you are infected, you should go get stuff, that is, by definition, a malicious activity.
Yes.
That they are on your system to be able to pop up that message, and then they're trying to buy and make you buy something.
Yeah.
It's absolutely... So I wouldn't say a bait and switch, but it's definitely a...
You judge that ethically wrong.
And that's why I'm calling.
Good point. Okay, Ryder's got a solution for you.
Okay, so there's
another one.
A freeware program called Hitman Pro, and you can go there, www.hitmanpro.nl or .com. Either one will take you there. It's a freeware program that basically, it pulls down a bunch of different other shareware and freeware, malware and spyware scanners. Incorporates them all together. It's just like a power blast to just scan everything. It takes a while. It took me about a half hour for it to run everything. But if you want a really thorough brute force method of just eliminating any spyware on your system, I'd recommend this.
Should I do the manual install?
Yeah. Actually, with Hitman Pro, you can probably just trust it.
It's all automated. It will install everything and run them all.
Ryder, one of the concerns I have about installing a whole bunch of spyware stuff is that it scans your system. It keeps track of things. You're adding a lot of bloat, if you will, to your system. So do you do that and then uninstall it, or what is your feeling about it?
You could do that. They will occasionally ask if you want resident programs. In my usage, I found that it didn't leave much of a fingerprint.
Okay, it sounds like we have another solution for spyware issues. Hitman Pro, we'll put it up on the site. Okay, thank you, Larry, very much for the call.
You know, I recommended running msconfig and getting rid of stuff in startup. Just be aware that on a laptop computer, a lot of the stuff that runs your laptop that like your keypad, it runs by third-party software.
Right.
And that loads up in that startup. So if you get rid of everything and you lose functionality in your laptop, that's probably why. And you'll need to go back in and determine which software does what.
Okay,
on
you just
laptop.
Mentioned like the touchpad not working anymore. Wouldn't that be very hard to then reactivate it without the mouse?
I guess it could be.
Yeah, for some people. So
I would look closely at what each of those applications are called. If you have a Toshiba notebook, most of those things have the word Tosh in it or in a Toshiba directory. You're probably okay leaving those alone.
Yeah, good point. Thank you very much for that clarification. We're going to go ahead and take another call, this time from Pacific Grove. Gene, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you. Hi, geeks.
Hi.
I got an audio question. When I bought my house, I did not have it wired all the way around. I was over at a friend's house recently, and he's playing music, and he showed me something called an iRock 440, I guess it was, FM wireless, FM transmitter, and he could play music and then go into another room and turn to a certain FM station, and that music he was playing in the other room came out on that speaker in the other room. And I'm going, that's neat. And then I see these things for sale at Circuit City and stuff called D-Links, and they look like little routers, and they talk about greater wireless performance, play music, view pictures or video. Is that the same thing?
No, different thing.
Completely different thing.
Okay, so the bane of FM broadcast engineers everywhere are these little FM transmitters. Uh-huh. And the basic idea, yeah, I actually have an iRock. The battery on those things, I mean, the ones that I had that take two AAA batteries, and they don't last very long. But basically what it is the FCC regulates FM transmission, right? And AM transmission. It's a pretty regulated field. And one of the things they say is that if you're under a certain power level, then it doesn't matter. If you're not doing it too strong, it's right. Okay to make noise in that spectrum. So what these companies have done and say, we can make a transmitter that's just barely legal, and it will go the width, you know, the distance of your car and half the distance of your house kind of thing, and we can sell this thing and it will work, and it does. So a lot of these transmitters are used in the car when your car doesn't have a way to plug in like an iPod or an MP3 player of some kind. You got a little transmitter. Sean's got one in his Prius that he uses for transmitting from his. What do you use for your music player, Sean?
An iRiver.
He transmits through this device, and then on his FM tuner, he just tunes it to a certain station. And it's fine. It's really works. They work really great. One issue with it is you're on the freeway, and you're listening to, 88.9, and somebody next to you has one of these transmitters, and they're passing you, and they have one that's tuned to 88.9. In their car, it's going to oversaturate this frequency, and they won't be able to listen to
QSB. It happens to me a couple times a week, mostly semi-trucks.
Yeah, I want to do it in my house.
Yeah, well, that's totally your choice. You can get these things. There's a lot of them. You're looking for an FM transmitter.
You go to an FM dial, though, that's not being used. I mean,
that's
like,
right.
And you go to 88.6. There is no 88.
Yeah, try to go higher on the band, because the lower band is public radios.
No, really.
Higher band's commercial radio.
It's really difficult to find one that's not being used. You may find that it's not being used in Santa Cruz, but when you drive to San Jose...
But he's doing it in his house. So
I'm just doing it in my house, and I'll find a station that doesn't work. But that's...
I know what you mean, Sean. That's totally one of the problems with them. Yeah.
So that would work, then?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to work.
Plug the iRock into... Would I plug it into my stereo system?
Yeah, your stereo system normally has a headphone jack. You can just plug it right into the headphone jack. You might need an adapter.
Do they still make iRocks?
I don't know, but I wouldn't get an iRock necessarily. What you're looking for is an FM transmitter. A whole bunch of companies make them.
Okay.
And...
that's not the same as those D-Link router things.
No. So D-Link router thing is actually a wireless access point. Now, there are other technologies where you can get a wireless access point, and you can get something that connects to the wireless access point and looks like a music player and connects to your stereo, but you're talking a little bit more expense. These things are under $30 for these little FM transmitters.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call.
Sure.
We're taking calls and questions on GeekSpeak. I'll give you the numbers in just 1 second. Just want to remind you that today on our program, we have Ryder Brooks, Sean Cleland, and Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. Rick Philman is waiting for your calls with questions and comments on technology. There's no one on the phone. In the 831 area code, you can call us at 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll-free anywhere in California and parts of Nevada, I think, and maybe the whole continental U.S. I don't know. Give it a shot. 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you're welcome to send us email, though. We take the phone calls first. So if you really want to get answered, give us a ring. One more time on the phone numbers, because the lines are empty, and we'll take any questions about computers or technology in general. 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Geeks, we got some fill time. Anybody got something?
You want more news stories?
Sure. News is good.
Sure. Okay. First of all, I have to get back there. Ah, here we go. Researchers have developed a very strong material. The best way to describe it would be super paper. It's these sheets of paper with that are carbon, mostly carbon, that they're finding is as strong or stronger than carbon nanotubes.
Oh, carbon paper is stronger than a tube? Well, I don't understand why.
I don't understand either. I'm not a material scientist. However, they are finding that it does have a greater tensile strength than they're finding for the theoretical carbon nanotubes. So this does have implications for the space elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to make them, because carbon nanotubes are just strong enough with some overhead to handle a ribbon from that's anchored to the Earth and goes up past geosynchronous orbit.
Way past geosynchronous orbit, actually.
Right.
I think it has to go another double.
Another length yeah. of that, yes.
But maybe not. Maybe with the weight, it doesn't have to be that.
Hundreds of thousands of kilometers.
The general concept of space elevator, a scientific sci-fi term, which now is pretty, I mean, it's feasible to do it. It's to produce a string that goes from the planet, a ribbon that goes to orbit. And basically, you'd then take an elevator car that would ride up this thing, and it would be a very inexpensive way to get into space.
Yes. The idea is that you're not using, because you're not using rockets, you don't have that huge waste. Every time you see the space shuttle go up, and that huge plume of smoke that comes out the back, that's all waste.
Right.
Now, so, let me get this straight. The ship would be climbing up this thing?
Yes. You would have robotic climbers.
Whoa.
And you'd
would
only
be
have
strong
to,
enough.
And you would only have to climb for the first half. The second half,
it's
if you were
on.
Going to be... Well, if you want to go up just to geosynchronous orbit, like you would carry a satellite up there and then release it at that altitude, and you're in geosynchronous orbit. On the other hand, if you wanted to go to, say, Mars, you would go up past the midpoint, and after you pass the midpoint, it's the centrifugal force of the Earth turning that's going to send you off in a whip-like motion, and that's a way to launch you off to other destinations.
Now, would this thing be dangerous for existing satellites?
If the satellites were moving at a high velocity at the same latitude as the ribbon, sure. If they're in geosynchronous orbit, they're not going to be moving.
Okay, but your news story was about a paper being stronger than nanotubes, or like
right.
a flat type of molecular structure of carbon being possibly
something
have a
they
higher
call, yeah, something
strength.
They call grapheme.
Graphene.
Which I don't really understand what that is. But I mean, it's a new organization of carbon atoms.
Right.
I can say that. However,
so is it going to be like flame retardant, or what practical purposes from a paper replacement perspective?
Oh,
no, it's not meant to replace paper as in what we write on.
Okay,
think of it as the strongest
material we can make. That's kind of what it is.
Right,
for tensile
it'd be it's a plumbing. Cousin of diamonds.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks, Miles. That's a good story. Let's see if we had. Okay, now we got four calls. All right. Good. who's on line one? Let's see. Oh, Will. Well, no, wait. Where is Will? Let's see what happens.
Line three.
Welcome to Geek Speak. Is this Will?
Oh, it is. How are you doing?
Hi, Will. What's your where are you calling from?
Watsonville.
Okay. What's your question today, Will?
Well, I guess it's more of a comment that I listened to the last caller when you guys were talking about the FM transmitters.
Sure.
And, I have one of the Griffin ones that I use that kind of attaches under the iPod, the five generation video iPod.
Yeah, sure.
And it doesn't work very well at all, especially around here because there's not a lot of free frequency.
And you're in Watsonville. And you're in Watsonville. Does this one? How many frequencies does this thing support?
I think the lowest it goes is 88.5, then it goes all the way up through. But it's funny because you have to find one that's not complete static, but kind of semi static. If it's complete static, it doesn't seem to work that well.
Really? That's strange. It should work really well on complete static.
Yeah. I have a iMonster version. It's three different programmables.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fully programmable, but you can choose from three different presets. And I find it works great on a completely static
one. Is that the one that plugs into the car lighter for charging?
It does,
stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues that, of course, if you're using a 12-volt power source from the car lighter, it's, well, the wattage would all be the same. But this one that connects to your iPod, does it have an antenna at all?
No, all it is, it's just one of those little rectangles that just plugs right into the bottom of it. So it actually runs off the power of the iPod. It doesn't
Runs off the power of the iPod, which they're going to really conserve that. And then, of course, it doesn't really have an antenna. These things should have antennas.
So we're talking about transmit power, basically.
Yeah.
So that might be part of the problem.
Yeah,
but I was going to say, for the other guy, he's going to use his stereo, and he has RCA cables. He could just plug those in.
Yeah, that's probably a better solution. I think you want to do it from any part in the house. Which is kind of cool, because if you do one of these little transmitters in the house, you can do it and transmit in one room and hook it up to your stereo right there, and also transmit right there and play in that room, and then go into the kitchen or the bedroom and turn on just a FM clock, and you can get your music from the other room at poor quality. But thank you very much for the call. So you don't recommend the Griffin?
I don't recommend it, because the other thing is it covers up the normal spot where the power cable would go in.
Yeah.
So like the one that you have, it sounds like, that goes in to the bottom of the iPod, it charges it and gives you transmission, where the Griffith, you actually have to go get another small USB cable.
Right.
It almost looks like what the new Razors take, that size USB kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't recommend it.
Well, thank you, Will, very much for the call.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. From Santa Cruz, we have Chris. Welcome to Geek Speak.
How you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today, sir?
I heard you speaking earlier about... spyware, and I presume you were talking about IBM material, IBM stuff, but what
Windows.
About for Mac?
Don't worry about it.
What about for Macintosh?
Don't worry about Macintosh spyware.
No.
You're safe.
Theoretically, it's a possibility, but...
It'll happen eventually.
Yeah.
But basically, right now, for spyware on Macintosh, I wouldn't really worry about it.
So it's the same status as viruses? There just aren't many?
There's just not many people making them.
The install base is so small that... hackers can't be bothered to...
I mean, have seen spyware on a Mac when you... I think an old version of LimeWire actually had an application that did, take a look at your web browsing and or your search results and gave you advertising, things like that.
And you can get tracking cookies.
Yeah, you can get tracking cookies,
Mac,
of course.
It's not anywhere near the same scale of the problems that you have on Windows.
Right. So, basically, it's true. Anti-spyware on the Mac is going to get rid of your cookies in your web browser. The basic concept of a cookie in a web browser is if you visit a site, they can set a little code for you. And then every time you visit this same site, they can look at that code and kind of know your traffic patterns. Because what they do is they put the advertising all on multiple sites, and the image of the advertising is actually served from one location. So from doing this, if you put it on 14 different sites, and the one user visits 10 of those, that advertiser knows that user visited only those certain ones. And the way... that these advertisers are doing this, they have thousands and thousands of ads all over the place, and they can get a pretty good profile on you as a user, but they don't know who you are.
And if you get ad blocking, like an ad blocking extension for Firefox or any of the ad blocking that's available for IE, although you're on a Mac, so it doesn't really apply, then the chances of a tracking cookie are slim to none.
So thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, Miles, what about Linux?
What about it?
Do you need to worry about spyware, malware with Linux too?
No, it's about the same as level on the Mac. Like you can have a tracking cookie, but that's
because AVG just released a version of their spyware, anti-spyware software for Linux.
It kind of makes sense, actually. It really has to do with the cookies, but also things like Winamp. If there's a Winamp and Winamp installs a whole bunch of other stuff, and you do that accidentally, it's kind of hard to uninstall it. And it's spyware at a level. It's a question of whether you want it or not. You're kind of supporting the program, the application. I mean, Sean, you talked about Winamp earlier, that great music player that you use for music playing. Sean,
yeah.
What are the applications that try to install with it? Do you consider those spyware, or just stuff you don't want?
Stuff I don't want.
You wouldn't call it spyware, though.
It just puts icons on your desktop.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't actually. I don't think it installs something that runs in the background with Windows. So it's clutter I don't need.
Yeah. But theoretically could install something that does run advertising for you.
It's like QuickTime installs this stuff called iTunes. I don't want that. So I say don't install that.
Have you used iTunes yet, Sean? You should try it. It's really good. Okay. from Gilroy, Phil, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, hi, pal. I don't know if this is in the realm of your, what you guys are talking about. I'm not quite sure. Just FM, what might you be able to tell me? Those might about FM reception with regards to... old-fashioned transmitters, I listen to KPEG radio a lot, along with you guys, this station and the other locals, listener-supported, and I get a lot of the others going red, but Do you know anything about that stuff? Are you guys just talking the iPod and all that? I'm living in the dark ages here.
Okay, so what's the problem? You have bad reception?
Bad reception, yeah.
Okay, the easiest way to deal with bad reception is to get a better antenna.
Amplified antenna?
Okay, yeah. I've got about a 6-foot directional antenna.
Oh, my.
And I'm up about roughly from ground level. I'm up at, about 18 feet at present.
And are you in a deep crevasse valley?
I'm in Gilroy. Roughly in the down below the, you know, if you go over Hecker Pass Highway, right. You guys should be familiar with that.
So I don't understand. You can hear KOSP, so why do you need anything else?
Well, no, I like it all. You know, I mean, I listen to you guys and I listen to them too. But, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of music. Oh, I like. I go the, you know, your style too.
Well, the only thing is those directional antennas. You know, is it one of those antennas that has multiple, wires coming off of it? Looks like a big, big like array kind of thing.
Yeah.
Each of those antenna segments is actually tuned to a certain frequency. It gives you a frequency boost in there. If that thing is designed, instead of for FM, it's designed for like UHF, for like television reception, those things aren't going to be tuned to FM, and then they're not really going to be useful to you. So you really need an FM antenna.
Well, it is.
FM antenna. I'm surprised you're not getting great reception on anything you want in Gilroy.
Well, they're coming out of Prunedale. You know, their transmitter is out of Prunedale. I'm just wondering, is the mountain?
I suggest calling them, because you... I know, as a KOSP listener, you're doing fine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't mean to insult you guys. I get where you're coming from now.
No, I thought
we maybe mix it up, because they are friends of yours.
Of course they are, definitely.
Laura Ellen was friends with KUSP and KZSC and KPFA KKUP. I listen to them
family.
All. So
yeah,
don't,
yeah.
All right.
No,
I got
I'm,
you, pal.
I'm just giving you a hard time. Bye-bye. All right, you are listening to KOSP. And in Gilroy, I guess we're well received. I guess I don't have any other solutions for him, but so better reset online
because he was saying it was directional. Is it tuning it directly to them? Yeah, yeah.
I'm surprised. I would assume you can get all those stations. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto. We're streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. I want to thank Miles Elam, Ryder Brooks, and Sean Cleland for visiting today on GeekSpeak. Thank you, geeks.
Thank you,
Lyle. Glad to be here.
I'm Lyle Troxell. Answering our phones every week is Rick Philman. Thank you, Rick, very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. And to those of you that called in and gave us feedback and talked to us, thank you so much. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronics parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Let's see, what else did I want to cover? Next week, we got a show topic. Chris Dunphy is going to be joining us. He's our traveling geek. He'll be here in Santa Cruz, and we'll have him on air. This program is supported by PreOwnedCar.com. PreOwnedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicles for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information is available at PreOwnedCar.com. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.